Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. We've got a very eclectic show for you today. Our studio guest is crime writer Peter Morfitt, talking about the latest novel in the Captain Darrick series, Box of Bones. We'll also hear from poet Caddy Bennion on her new collection, The Tidal Wife, and Jan Todd will be talking about Radiation Diaries, a memoir of her experience of undergoing treatment for cancer. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Peter.
Thanks for inviting me.
Lovely to have you here. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but Caddy's collection and Jan's memoir that we'll be hearing about later in the show, very personal stories. So how much of yourself is in your novels?
Well, I can hear my wife Liz laughing already. I'm not quite as magnificent as my central character, Paul Darrick, is, although we share some things in common. One of those being a wide-ranging love of jazz from many different periods. That we do share.
And and it's set in the French Riviera, which I know you're a particular fan of that area.
My love affair with that began, as with so many other people, a summer holiday, which is our first as a young family going abroad for the first time. And we were quite simply overwhelmed, you know, in that moment when the plane door opens and you stand there for the first time, this is abroad, we were thinking. And the heat, you know, the exotic smells, not all of them sweet, but above all, that radiant southern light, that was the thing that was captivating. And that, you know, that was sort of began a love affair. You know, as with many love affairs, we've had our ups and downs, France and me. But 30 plus years later, it's a love that's still strong. And anyone who is familiar with Nice knows that backed by that amazing Alpe Maritime mountain range, and with the eponymous Azure coastline at its feet, it's as beautiful, really, as any Mediterranean resort. But it's also a multi-ethnic city with 500,000 souls, and so it has its fair share of problems and crime, and that's where my central character, Captain Paul Darrick, comes in.
Yeah, well, you do bring that area really to life in your novel. Well, let's hear your first choice of music now. Do you listen to a lot of music, Peter?
I do, yes. I love all kinds of music. And
this is Fresh Garbage by Spirit.
Yes, and I wasn't into jazz originally. I got into it indirectly, actually, by listening to the jazzier aspects of the rock groups I liked, and sort of people like Steely Dan and Frank Zappa and so on. And this is Fresh Garbage from their first album, entitled Spirit, from 68. And in the middle of the piece, there's a really lovely electric piano solo with a rolling bass behind it. And it was things like that that made me want to explore jazz more fully.
That was Fresh Garbage by Spirit, the first choice of music on Bookmark today by a studio guest, Peter Morfitt. Peter has written for TV, radio and the stage for programmes such as Coronation Street and Week Ending. He's the author of the satirical novel Birksie, a spoof ghosted autobiography of fictional footballer Stephen Birks. Time Out described it as a cult classic. His first Captain Darrick mystery, Impure Blood, published in 2016, was the US Library Association's Pick of the Month. The second, Fatal Music, was one of Strand Magazine's top 25 books of 2017. The third, Box of Bones, which came out earlier this year, was described by Shots Magazine as an accomplished piece of crime fiction. Well, obviously, we're going to talk about Box of Bones in a lot of detail, Peter, but let's just take a look at that. Three books in 3 years. That's going some.
This is entirely because I'm a late bloomer in everything, really. I didn't write anything creative until I was well into my 40s. And you know, really, the only thing in which I was quick off the mark was in getting married. I met my wife, Liz, when she was 17. I was a couple of years older. And we married the following year. And now 40-odd years later, let me rephrase that, 40-plus years.
Let's keep it a mystery.
Yes, 40-plus years later, and not even slightly odd years. Later, you know, we still are married. But we had our children early and very young parents. And so we didn't settle on our ultimate career paths until many years later. And instrumental in this was the late lamented grant system, which meant that we were able to take up places at university. I read the history and theory of art, and then we went on to obtain PhDs. And at that point, Liz decided to go into teaching in the university administration, and which she's still doing. And I picked up a variety of part-time things, academic and others. And between those and my other role as chief cook and bottle washer at home, I found I had the time to really scratch this increasingly persistent urge to write something creative. And down the line, those scratches turned into words on paper.
That was why you started writing, was it? It was kind of to scratch an itch. You'd always wanted to do some creative writing.
I suppose I had, but when I did start writing, it was comedy scripts that I, you know, did. And I have to say, I mean, it is a real thrill to be able to put words into the mouths of actors as talented as David Haig and Peter Davison and Mackenzie Crook and people like that. And I guess for a scriptwriter, nothing much tops that moment at a cast read-through when an actor you've admired all your life, like the late, great Michael Williams, can't deliver a line because he's laughing so much. I mean, that is a terrific moment. And also an indication that if, you know, the actors are laughing, then probably people will at home. But my first love, I always enjoyed comedy, but my first love is crime fiction, really. And I didn't know whether I would be able to write any long form prose piece at all. I'd only written scripted material before, and comedy, you know, that comedy dramas for radio and sketch shows for telly. And so I thought, well, I better stick in my comfort zone. And as you mentioned, the first thing I wrote was a comic novel about a satire on popular culture, featuring a gifted footballer but monstrous idiot called Birksie. And, you know, and that seemed to do okay. And then shortly after that, I thought, yeah, well, now I can start kicking around the ideas that, you know, have eventually turned into the Darak mystery series. And 500,000 words or so later, I finished a fourth novel, actually, just a couple of months ago.
Yes,
so I hope I can remember Box of Bones.
We'll
find out.
Remind us of Box of Bones. For people who haven't read Box of Bones, what is it about?
Well, it's the third in my series of police procedural crime novels set in the southern French city of Nice to feature my central character, Captain Paul Darak of the Serious Crime Squad, the Brigade Criminelle. This third story, set against the backdrop of Nice's annual carnival, which is the largest and the most spectacular in France. A dramatic incident at the carnival sets in train a series of events which prompts Darak, my central character, to re-examine a celebrated case solved years previously by his beloved boss and mentor, Commissaire Agnès Dantier. Powerful forces then surface, and a story of blind ambition and escalating murder unfolds, a story which stretches Darak's investigative skills and his emotional resources to their limits.
It's a very enjoyable read. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh,
and
thank you very much.
Part of the reason was the setting, which I mentioned earlier. And obviously, we discussed your love for the setting.
Yeah.
But why did you set a novel there? What does it offer you that setting it in Cambridge wouldn't offer you?
It's this love of the exotic. I mean, my interest in crime fiction, you know, started with the hard-boiled school of Hammett, Chandler. My favourite, personally, is Ross Macdonald, through Patricia Highsmith into contemporary writers like Mankell and Walter Mosley, and closer to home, Cambridge's own Jim Kelly, who I know you interviewed recently,
and
you know, a fantastic crime writer. But I must admit to a penchant, even a weakness, for even averagely written crime fiction, if the series is set abroad. And so sort of predisposed, really, to you know, foreign-set crime stories. But, of course, you know, with that comes problems. You are most obviously becoming conversant with, you know, a policing and judicial system very different from ours. Logistical problems, possibly problems with language as well.
I wondered about that because when as I was reading it, I was thinking these characters, it's written in English, obviously, but these characters are speaking in French. You're aware of that when you're writing, and presumably the implications of every word and the nuances of
it's tricky words. That, as you say, I determined earlier on when I, you know, began this thing that I wouldn't sort of transliterate. You know, French people, for example, don't say it's raining cats and dogs, or it's binning it down, like I would say, hailing from my native Huddersfield. They say it's raining string.
You know,
il pleut des cordes, they say. It's raining string. But I didn't want to litter these books with these phrases that I know. I think it, on the whole, it's confusing. So I've adopted this approach of just keeping everything very English. If, you know, I'm like, I probably wouldn't use the expression it's binning it down or it's siling it down, another favourite West Yorkshire expression, but I might go as far as cats and dogs. I certainly wouldn't transliterate that.
And the heart of all these novels is Captain Darrock himself. Where did he come from?
Well, yes, I mean, he's an interesting character. And of course, that is the key question, you know, how distinctive is your, you know, where does he come from? And of course, you know, publishers wouldn't be interested in a detective that didn't stand out from the pack. But it struck me that perhaps too many authors lately had sought an answer to this problem of a distinctive detective in the form of the damaged detective. And, you know, I mean, obviously your lead character or any character needs some flaws to be credible. Contradictions are useful and so on. But you know, Darrock has some of those. He has a combustible temper, to name one thing. But I decided to deny him the more destructive and self-destructive urges and conditions that seem to bedevil the lives of a lot of lead detectives nowadays. And
well, that's quite refreshing to a reader, I think.
He
seems quite normal.
You know? He is. He's a warm-hearted man who likes people. He loves his friends.
He loves his jazz.
He loves his jazz. He's, you know, he has a good, I kind of admire his life, really, in lots of ways.
Do you know his story? Do you know where he's going to end up?
I do, yeah. I do. If I get the opportunity to write that far, I know exactly where he's going. As I say, I've actually just completed the fourth novel as well. That takes things further. But yeah, so he's a man who lives not so much on the edge, but on the cusp of things. Even where he lives is on the edge of the, you know, one part of the city and another. And I just thought, as you say, and I'm delighted to hear that you found that refreshing, because that was entirely my aim.
You know, just to have a normal hero, as you say, is not an alcoholic, who's not using drugs or visiting prostitutes. Do you see him in your mind's eye when you write?
Yes.
Is he somebody we might recognise?
Yes. I didn't realise I hadn't done it in this novel. I may have, but I mean, it's such a fleeting reference that you probably wouldn't have noticed. But in the other novels, when he goes to the jazz club, the owner of that jazz club is an American guy called Ridge Clay. And he calls Darrock Garfield. He calls him that. And to begin with, in the first novel, I don't explain why he does that, but eventually you learn that it's because he bears a resemblance to the old Hollywood actor John Garfield, who was a very kind of... He played a boxer in one movie. He's got a very sensitive face, though. He's a kind of odd combination of this kind of broad-boned face, but sensitivity there as well, especially in the eyes. So that's who I see.
I'm glad I relieved you, sir. Not a cat.
No, not Garfield.
Large orange and black cat.
Well, he jokes. I mean, cat, you know, is one of those jazz words. You know, people are cats. And so somebody asks him, why does he call you Garfield? And, you know, he replies, oh, maybe he thinks I'm a cat, you know, which kind of confuses people for a bit. But, yeah, no, I'm glad that you find him refreshing, because that's entirely my aim. You know, living on the cusp of things where worlds collide and intersect is, you know, and when I came up with that sort of idea for him, I felt really excited by it. And I'll never forget that feeling of excitement. You know, this was a warm-hearted but strong-minded person who we can all kind of get behind. And I thought, I really want to be on board whilst this guy does all these things. You know, it was a very strong feeling I had.
Excellent. Well, we'll come back. We'll talk more about Darak in just a moment. We'll hear from Caddy Banyan next. Caddy's first poetry collection, Milk Fever, published in 2012, won the Crawshaw Prize and was shortlisted for the Picador Poetry Prize. Formerly a scriptwriter for Hollyoaks and Grange Hill, she's now a Granter New Poet and in recent years has collaborated with artist Miranda Bolton and Adam Brooks Hospital. Many of the poems in The Tidal Wife were inspired by her week-long residency on the island of Egg, off the west coast of Scotland, sponsored by the Bothy Project. It was published earlier this year, and I asked Caddy why the six-year gap between collections one and two.
I was actually writing another collection at the time, so this is actually my third written collection, but the number two isn't edited yet. And I kind of got hijacked by ideas for this book when I was writing what should have been book number two, which was a retelling of The Snow Queen. So that collection is coming quite soon, but this one obviously wanted to come first.
And this collection published by Salt again, as your first collection was, so obviously you have a good relationship with them.
I do have a good relationship with them, yeah. Chris is lovely at Salt, and he's quite patient with me because I do endlessly make changes and make his head explode.
And this is called The Tidal Wife, a collection of poems about islands, literal and metaphorical.
Yeah. So I was very drawn to physical islands. At the time of writing it, I was really tired and a bit overwhelmed with family life and work life. And I was looking for a holiday for the four of us, just somewhere really remote. And I remembered my first poetry teacher talking about two mythical islands that were Avalon and Lindisfarne. And at the time, I knew Avalon is an old word for Glastonbury, which is somewhere I've been to, but I thought Lindisfarne didn't even exist. So I looked it up. And there it was, this little tiny tidal island off Northumberland. And I was just like, we've got to go there. And we've been back every year since 2014 because we all fell in love with it.
And what is it about islands that appeals to you?
What's come up in the writing of this book is that I experience an internal state that is quite like I need to be cut off from everybody. I need to be an island, mostly in order to be creative. So I think an island or several islands to write about rose up out of the sea because that was my ideal state in order to be able to write. And a lot of this book came from the frustration of just not having enough time to pursue my creative life.
And it's called The Tidal Wife, so there's obviously something about the tides as well.
Yeah, there is. There's a real back and forth feel throughout the whole collection. Possibly mainly in the Lindisfarne section, which is section three, where I really focus on the tides and kind of what they bring in to the seashore, what's mimetic in me about my sort of undulating moods and what can be taken away or cleaned away or processed by something like a tide.
So when you started writing these poems, did you see it as a possible collection?
No, not at all. It was the... We had 1 week in Lindisfarne in April 2014, and I arrived there. I was really unwell. I had some kind of throat infection and fever, so I had put a notebook in my bag, but I wasn't expecting to write, and I was very full of the Snow Queen poems at the time. That was going okay at the time. And during that week, I had ideas for 33 poems about islands. Just, I don't know what was untapped in me, but something came pouring out on that first visit.
And these poems are about decay, they're about life cycle, they're quite visceral.
Yeah, and I think that's probably expanding on some of the themes that were just emerging when I wrote Milk Fever. I am very interested in the cycles and all the sort of muck and despair and difficult conflicting feelings. I think it's sort of important not to present just one beautiful, pristine landscape. I want all the rubbish as well.
And these poems also look at your life as a mother, mm-hmm. a daughter, a yeah. wife. They're quite personal.
Yeah, they are. And I think when I was writing one of the sections, the sky section, my sort of dearest mother figure had just died. The family live in America, so I wasn't able to go to the funeral. I was really processing that and just like, how can I be a good enough mother to my own children? When I feel lost, I feel like a child again. And I when I was growing up, I learnt so much from that particular woman.
And how does it feel putting so much of yourself on the page? Where do you draw the line?
Yeah, it is difficult. I wrote about this in my MA dissertation about what's the difference between the personal eye and the poetic eye. And for some reason, I think, especially with readers, they can often assume with poetry that when you use the first person, it is from, you're writing something from your own experience. And to be fair, largely I do, but of course I use poetic license to make better poems. My aim or my project when I'm writing poetry is the best possible poems. So it might start with a feeling or a situation that's going on with me, but then I'm likely to change it or expand it.
Yes, you're right. The first person in a novel we would never assume was the yeah. novelist or the writer, but yeah. you do in poetry.
Yeah, it's one of the pitfalls, I think, of poetry that I've heard a lot of interviews and seen a lot of other poets speak where they get this question and nearly everybody says the same thing. Just don't assume it's me because it might not be me.
And if you wanted somebody to take something away from the collection, I mean, there's an awful lot in it, but is there one thing, one message that you are trying to deliver?
Yeah, I think it is the word retreat is very integral to the collection for me because through writing it, I realised I needed to stop. I needed to sort of retreat into myself and just take a bit of time, which is why it has taken me, like, I suppose a second collection should come 2 or 3 years if there is a should to it after a first. But I really needed to go somewhere, and physically I needed to go to these three different islands, which are quite far away.
So, and your husband's mentioned in the poems, as are yeah. your children.
Yeah.
Have you shown them to them? How do they feel about it?
Well, my daughter, who's 14, pretends she doesn't know me. But I did a reading, or I judged a poetry competition at her school last week, and she walked me into school and she was like, "Mummy, have you got your packed lunch? Have you got a bottle of water? Now you're going to be okay, all right?" And I just had the sense that actually she's quite proud. And even though she doesn't want me to read the poems that are specifically about her to her school for obvious reasons, I think she's quite contented that they exist. My son's 10. I think poetry isn't really on his radar. He just sees lots of books and mummy reading all the time and scribbling something, and but I don't think he thinks much about it yet.
And your husband's a writer, so that must
help.
He
is a writer, yeah. And we were talking about poetry last night. We were talking about Dylan Thomas, and he said, even though he's got a degree in English literature, he said, "I'm not confident about talking about poetry. I don't really know what it is." So we write in very different genres, and he doesn't read my poems as I write them. And there's one particular one in this new collection that I hope he will like because it's for him, and it's about when we very first knew each other years and years ago. We went swimming. I love swimming, and he didn't tell me that he couldn't swim. And he was like this animal that shouldn't be let near water. And I said that phrase to him, and it's just one of our jokes that he is an animal that shouldn't be let near water, and it's quite alarming / hilarious to watch him trying to swim.
Are you going to read some poems for us now?
I am, yeah. The first one I was going to read is from the section about an island called Egg, which I was very lucky to get a residency to in 2016. And that was the first time I had lived on my own as an adult for a week. I lived in a hut. So this is about how healing that was for me. It's called Nest Egg. It was John the Bird who warned me to be careful when out walking the moors, not to step on a hen harrier's nest camouflaged in the wild gold grass. I tread warily, even inside the bothy, afraid I may break something, afraid I may break myself. I've come to feel sheltered here, a chick tucked up in its shell-domed sack and warmed under a yoke of lamplight. Afternoons I curl under a tartan blanket, two oat cakes, a hot tin mug of fennel tea, leafing through Camille's History of the Island as the light outside putters out. This poem is the final poem in the collection, and I suppose the one thing I haven't mentioned is how important light is across the collection, and sort of things shattering broken glass and then coming back together and maybe a new light forming. It's called Lit. It will be days before I'll know what to do with it. This bag full of glass shivers, my bounty. Here, see how this bottleneck slips onto my finger, or how this thick jar end gleams, now cleaned, after its emergence in reverse from the crumbling cliff, little breach from a dusty womb. Sometimes I like to rub the smooth edges on my wrists, feel the jigger of an old risk, dulled now with time, hold on to a brokenness that gave way to a whole. It hits like a voltage in the small hours, the still small hours of our final night, my first unfevered sleep. I see a vase, so clearly it is crystal, coiled inside a string of tiny lights, all my harvested glass packed in snug from base to cusp, the switch flicked and a lamp lit for my children, my children's children.
And The Tidal Wife by Caddy Benyon is published by Salt. Peter Morfoot is with me on Bookmark. Have you written any poetry, Peter?
The very first thing I ever wrote in my life. Now, this is going to give the lie to everything I've said before when I was talking about being a late bloomer. But as a kid, I wrote a poem, and it was about the First World War. I'd just seen a programme on telly, and I thought, what is this destruction all about? I don't think I used the word destruction. I was really young, and I sent it off to, it might have been Yorkshire Life magazine, and they published it. And then for about the next 30 years, I didn't write another thing. I thought, you know, I've arrived.
Well, rest on your laurels.
I'd arrived.
Yes,
you
peaked very early.
But I do admire the kind of attention to the very, very precise and small things that, you know, you get in poetry. And we heard it there. I mean, very moving stuff.
Well, let's hear your second choice of music now, which is Potato Head Blues by Louis Armstrong and Hot 7. It's poetry and music, I suppose.
Well, yes. Well, France's long love affair with jazz is another reason that I chose that as the metier for Darac. He's what's known as a poet policier in France. There's a whole tradition of this, police officers who are also fully fledged good artists. And it was Nice, actually, that staged the first jazz festival in history, and that was in 1948. And it starred Mr. Louis Armstrong. And Darac's taste in jazz, this is something we do share, is very wide, very modern, but also covering all eras, goes right back to this. And this is 1927. And this has such life and great energy, this music, that Darac thinks of it, and in the second book, Fatal Music, actually refers to it. He says, "This is the greatest argument there is for the existence of the human race."
And our studio guest on Bookmark this week is Peter Morfoot, talking about his crime novel, Books of Bones. We're going to hear an extract now from that novel. Do you want to give us a bit of an introduction to it, Peter?
Yes, I will. Every year on the anniversary of his mother's early death, Darak and his family hold an informal service of commemoration at her graveside in the old cemetery at Vence, where he's from, just a few miles from Nice. The occasion this time is marred when shots ring out from an adjoining street. Darak rushes away to investigate and pursuing the culprit in his car until a crash ends the chase. On his way back to join the party at the cemetery, Darak decides to pull over and take stock of what's happened.
As the road shelved around the spur above Les Baux, Darak slowed and pulled over. The cloud cover was all gone now. Under a sky of deepening azure, he stood for a moment, the vast panorama of the Alpes Maritimes laid out before him. It was a view dominated by the bow, four upthrust knuckles of rock that seemed to pull taut the high, time-scented ridge that stretched between them. It was a landscape he'd known all his life, a landscape his mother loved above all others. Darak hadn't noticed the mud-splattered 4x4 that had fallen in behind him as he left the crash site. Still contemplating the landscape, he didn't notice it as it rolled to a stop alongside his Peugeot, screening it from the road. In the vehicle were three tough-looking individuals. Each was heavily armed. A rear window slid silently down. An assault rifle pointed at Dirac's spine. Dirac flinched.
"Now you're really dead, Captain,"
the officer said. Deploying the armed protection unit proved to have been Commissaire Agnès Dantier's idea. Dirac called her.
"How many of these guys are there altogether, Agnès?"
"Six. The other three are dotted around outside the cemetery."
"Well, I don't need them now."
"Listen, our dear prosecutor Frenne has to dig deep into the budget for them, so be grateful."
"Dug how willingly, out of interest?"
"His little arms were going like pistons once I suggested he might be the next target."
"It had to be something like that."
"But look, Agnès, the shooter's dead."
"I know he is, but suppose he's part of a group."
"If he was the best they had, they're not much of a group. He was a real amateur, believe me. Crap driver, too."
There was no gainsaying her. At least Dirac knew the guys wouldn't get in the way. You saw the APU, only if they wanted it that way.
And that recording was produced by Matt Bentman. The voices you heard there were James Steadman, Helen Mulligan and Thomas Stockbridge. Peter, Agnès Dantier is referred to in that extract there. There's quite a band around Darak, isn't there? It's a very buzzing police officer. Quite challenging for you as a writer to differentiate all those for the reader.
And a challenge for the reader to pick up on this. But you know, Darak's very much an individual, but attesting to the essentially collaborative nature of all police work, I needed him to be a team player as well. And so, you know, that's what I did. I've surrounded him with a large cast of supporting players, as it were. But, you know, and I hope that readers will engage with those supporting characters.
Well, it feels like a real police station to me. You know, there are tensions, there's banter, there's misunderstandings, there's women in senior positions. Hey, who would have thought? How did you research that? Did you spend time in a police station?
Yeah. Lots of reading, but very typically of France. When I thought, well, there's nothing, you know, I have to talk to a senior officer in Nice. You know, I'd done a lot of reading, and so, you know, overtures were made. And finally, a remarkable man called Commandant Zuccarelli of Commissariat Foch in Nice agreed to meet me. Well, I've been going to Nice for donkey's years, but I have, you know, 40,000-year-old A-level French. And a dear friend of ours lived in Paris and taught French for 10 years. And she's actually acknowledged in all the books. Catherine Rodwell, her name is. And she came along and did the live translation as I interviewed Commandant Zuccarelli. And through him, all the things that I hadn't been able to find out at all, I was able to. You know, the Caserne Ovar, exactly where the Caserne Ovar was, and all of that. But, you know, when you have a large cast of characters like this, I mean, my view is, yes, it is a bit of a challenge, but it does offer the most immersive reading experience in the end. And I'm delighted that you thought, actually, this feels like a real police operation, because, you know, nothing is more irritating to me than the idea of a senior officer and a sergeant sorting out a case, probably in the pub over a pint.
before one of them scares away and drinks even more, yes.
Exactly, and that can lead all too easily to what I call the yes, that's it school of denouement, you know, whereby a chance remark from the sergeant causes the lead detective, that's it, he says. You know,
the light bulb moment.
Exactly, the detective says, oh, I've got to go home and do the decorating now. And
there is a romantic subplot within the book as well. Did you feel the need to put that in?
Yes, and I wanted to. I mean, somebody said, your books feel, this is a bit self-aggrandizing, I suppose, but your books feel very vibrant and alive, and I do feel as if I'm dipping into real lives here. So, this is a subplot that's been going on from the first book, and in the fourth book that I've just finished, comes to even more of a head than it does in this. And I'm a huge fan of screwball comedy. Screwball comedy, some of the writers of screwball comedy, my favourite, writers, Ben Hecht, that wrote everything from, the screenplay of Notorious, the Hitchcock film, to laugh out loud screwball comedies. And I try and get a bit of that into the relationship between Derek and the person you're referring to, who's Frankie, who's a very bright and vibrant person who can match any man when it comes
to... Yes, I loved Frankie. Well, you mentioned dipping into real lives there. Let's hear from Jan Todd now. Jan is a scholar of early women writers and has published work and biographies on Jane Austen, Aphra Behn and Mary Wollstonecraft. A former president of Lucy Cavendish College, Cambridge, her first novel, A Man of Genius, came out last year. Philippa Gregory described it as strange and haunting, a gothic novel with a modern consciousness. Radiation Diaries, subtitled Cancer, Memory and Fragments of a Life in Words, is a record of her treatment for pelvic cancer. When I met Jan, I asked her why she'd written the book.
I wrote it at the time. I wrote it as comfort for myself, as something to stop me panicking. Writing is very therapeutic for me. So every morning I was up terribly early and I wrote it while it was happening, and then I wrote in the evening. So it was entirely a sort of prophylactic against fear and panic. Some years later, somebody asked me about it and I showed it to a publisher. And by that point, I think I had not realised that it might to some people seem unseemly and perhaps overly frank about bodily and indeed psychological matters. But I'm old and I don't know that I care so much as I did. But this is the age in which you often do look back over your past and want to sort of say, well, I was here and this is what I thought. And I suppose it was a bit of that exhibitionism that made me want to publish it. I could never write a whole memoir because there's so many aspects of my life I would never wish to put before anybody or think about again. But this had brought up unexpectedly archaeological layers of the past that I hadn't thought of a lot. And I thought it was possibly worth publishing.
So when you decided to publish, did you go back and edit it?
Well, I didn't edit any of the actual discussion of the, description of what it was like in the hospital, the treatment, none of that. All that is exactly as it was, because it was my very incomprehension that was part of the, of the story and part of the problem of it. I did cut out some statements about people and remarks about particular doctors, because these were ignorant remarks and then part of the panicky resolve of the time. And I checked some quotations which I'd entirely misattributed at the time.
It is very frank and it is quite exposing. You reveal a lot about yourself physically and emotionally, about your past. You've no regrets about that?
Well, I do when people find it unseemly and tell me, or when they say, and this is what sometimes is said, how very brave of you, and you know what they're merely saying, I would not, and I wouldn't, it feels like stripping yourself naked in the high street, as I said at the end. I mean, this is what many people feel, and I probably have been too frank, but I think one of the things that I do say about myself is that I don't know what people think, other people think, not very clearly. I'm not very good at judging response, and I'm always surprised at it. And I do tie this to what I saw in those memories, which I hadn't really thought about before, how very solitary my childhood had been. I don't think I'd really taken that on board, and how, without siblings or close friends or relatives for most of the time, I didn't really work out how to get the right tone to make yourself entirely likeable. Yes, I don't like it when people find that it's overfrank and not sufficiently reticent, but I don't think I could be anything else or write in any different way.
And yes, as you say, the treatment allowed you to... It provided a trigger, really, didn't it, for reflection, not just on the present and the future, but on the past. Was that a surprise to you?
I think it was a surprise, but it's a sense that the body has taken over, and it was a very debilitated time, and I couldn't read, which is my usual way out of everything. And so memories pounced on me in a way that I hadn't expected at all. And looking back on it, of course, first of all, I think that the memories of the first 20 years do dominate you for the rest of your life. But it was also that the way in which feminism, for me, had been very much about agency, about controlling the female body, having control over it. And here in a hospital is the place where you lose that control. Other people take it over. And the time in my life when that was most salient was in a boarding school, which I think, if you've read it, you will know I loathed with some intensity. And that was the other time when I was deprived of words. I think I describe how, being an insomniac, I wanted to read under the blankets and they took the torch. It was a bit like that in the hospital. I couldn't really read properly. And actually under the machine, which I know only a short time, but I was completely deprived of words. And I realise how much everywhere I go, I take a book. And in hospital, there I was without the words. And so I think all these things came up. The mind itself, the layers of the mind, took over in a way I had not really anticipated.
So how did it feel for you, now, 5, 6 years later, looking back at that Jan and what that Jan was going through?
Well, some of it has remained. I mean, some of the physical disability is still there, and the tiredness and all the various aspects of post-cancer are still with me. And the sense of impending death is always there now. If somebody says, how about we plan something for you to give a talk in May next year, I think, I don't know about that. Not sure, I'll be there. Life without my father is odd. He was the buffer against death, and so it's hard to go back to that world in which he was so dominating a presence. So I think things are very different now, but not so completely different that I don't understand the person who wrote that. I don't know, I was in two minds about publishing it. Right down to the end, I kept saying, I don't know, should I do this? But I think it's just part of the desire, perhaps, of an old person to say they were around and this is what happened to me and this is what I did. I can still relate to that person very clearly.
And is there any part of you that's grateful is the wrong word, but that appreciates that, however awful it was having the treatment and living with this, that it's given you the opportunity to sit down and reflect?
I think I am, slightly. It's an odd thing to say. What I have realised is that I'm now retired, and I thought that my personality was and identity were entirely tied up with my job, my academic job. And I realised at the end of this that it isn't and hasn't been, really. So to that extent, I think it's useful. And the sense that if I didn't have certain physical problems and realised that decay is coming, that this is possibly one of the best periods of my life, that I quite like being old. There's a certain anonymity about it. If you've got the physical strength to do all sorts of things and be all sorts of things and hold opinions, in many ways, I think it was a bit of a watershed, yes.
And of course your story isn't just your story, it affects the people around you, your friends and family, and they are in the book. How did you choose what to tell of their story, and how much did you choose to keep back?
Well, I thought that it was my story, so I should not put in other people. There were people I spoke to in the hospital, and I did not include them. And if I mentioned one or two, I covered them totally, even changing the places they came from. And I thought that was the same with my children. It's not their story. They do come in, but they don't come in very often, and they're not as prominent as they are actually in my life. Difficult to keep my husband out of it. But again, I don't go into their interior or imagine many feelings of theirs. So I didn't think it would be right to talk about aspects of other people's lives.
And what did your children and your husband think of these diaries?
My children haven't read them.
Really?
They're terribly busy, that's why, you know. One's always caving in up a mountain or whatever and hasn't got round to it yet, though it's on order, he says. And the other one just hasn't. I mean, it's just these two's incredibly full of a full-time job and two children. So, but she will. I don't know what they'll think. But they grew up with a non-reticent mother. I imagine they won't be totally surprised at what I do. And I have not really included much about them. I hope that they will be moved by what I say about their grandfather, who was very, very important in their lives. So once I was divorced, there was really no paternal influence again. And my father took that place, I think, for them. And so I hope they don't find my talking about his physical weakness at the end in any way unseemly and inappropriate, because I did write about him with love, and I hope that that comes through.
And what about your husband?
Well, he did read it, and he, again, was one of those who said, well, I don't think he would do it. But then he's a man, and there are different modes, I think, on the whole, for men, and he's probably more private. But he's also an only child and shares some of my characteristics, I think. But in the end, he thought it was good. He said he did, anyway. He was a very supportive man.
For people who read this book, is there a takeaway message that you have for people? Is there something that you want a reader to take away?
Well, if it's helpful to somebody, I'd be very happy about that. It's not a self-help book, as you must realise. But I think it might be helpful to somebody going into it or knowing somebody, because I came through it. It was nasty, but I came out of the other end. And I do think that one way through a lot of it, and through old age too, is creativity, is to do something, express yourself in some way, whether it's through knitting or dancing or making music or writing or painting. I needed that writing as I went on, but if I could draw the hospital every morning, it would probably have come to the same thing. Something that separates the vulnerable self from the outside world by expressing the two together, I think is very helpful. It seemed to me that it might be helpful, or might be something that might comment on old age as well. Because old age is so mocked in our society. You're not allowed to mock women anymore, or other races, or even working class and so on. You have certain areas now that are not to be made the objects and butts of comedy. But old women are. Somehow old age is still acceptable as a butt of young people's comedy. Whereas I think it might be useful for the young to know a bit more about it. When I was young, and looking at other young people, you can't really believe that you will ever be old. But one certainty is that if you're not dead, you will be old. So it would be as well if there was a little more compassion about it. And understanding, because perhaps compassion is the wrong word. Understanding. Because old people don't necessarily want pity. But the sense that they are somehow beyond the pale is very irritating.
And Radiation Diaries by Jan Todd is published by Fenton Press. I'm afraid we're coming to the end of our time with you on Bookmark, Peter Morfitt. We've been talking to you about Box of Bones, which is published by Titan Books. And you say you've just finished the fourth one. That's coming out very soon then?
Hopefully it will next year. And that one's called Knock 'em Dead.
Knock 'em Dead, like the sound of that. And a question we ask all our guests on Bookmark is, what are you reading at the moment? What's on your bedside table?
A favourite writer of mine is Joseph Cannon, who wrote The Good German and several other things. A fantastic dialogue writer. And Stardust, which is an early book of his, I hadn't read before. I think I'd read all the others, but I'm halfway through that, and as always, thrilling to this incredible dialogue writing, amongst other things that he does. Very jealous of it.
Well, lovely talking to you today, Peter. We're going to sign out now with your last choice of music, which is... Good. Oh, I should give everybody a heads up, first of all, on what's the next show. Our studio guest is Mick Finley, talking about his novel Arrowwood. We'll also hear from Jacob Sagar Weinstein on his fantasy adventure, The City of Secret Rivers. And we'll hear from Mandy Morton on the latest book in her series about the number two feline detective agency, Magical Mystery Paws. So back to your last choice of music, Peter, which is Goodbye Pork Pie Hat by Charles Mingus. It says here Charlie Mingus, we kind of know him as, don't we?
Yeah, we do, yes.
Why this one?
Well, this is the tune that an exhausted Darak winds down to following the cataclysmic conclusion to the case he tackles in the first Darak story, In Pure Blood. It's the small hours by the time he gets back to his top-floor apartment in the old town of Nice, a quarter known as the Babazouk. And he goes out onto his roof terrace, lies back and gazes at the stars, and while the sounds and smells of the Babazouk night rise up all around him, this drifts across from the apartment.
Thank you, Peter.